Welcome. Welcome to Silicon Flatirons and our patents and free and open source software conference. I'm Wendy Seltzer. I've been a research fellow at Silicon Flatirons this year, and I just wanted to open by thanking Paul Ohm and the other members of the Silicon Flatirons community here at the law school, and the Boulder community, which has been a really vibrant place to study technology, intellectual property, and innovation. Just the other day at one of the Boulder Open Coffee Clubs, we were musing about why it is that there is so much software development, technology, startup activity here in Boulder. And while it's beautiful out there, even when there's snowfall in the morning, it's also that there is really a crowd of interested people and people willing to share their thoughts and ideas and insights with the community. And so most of all, I want to thank all of you who are participating either as panelists or as audience members joining in the questions and conversations. And one way to do that is through our Twitter feed. If you use Twitter and use the hashtag Flatirons, that's the #Flatirons, then they'll show up in this search, and not while the panelists are talking, but during the breaks, and for those who can't turn their attention away from web browsers, in between, you'll be able to collect with that hashtag what members in the audience are saying to comment on the panels or participate in the discussion. With that, I'll turn it over to Paul Ohm to introduce us formally. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Paul Ohm. I'm an associate professor here, and I have a very long title with the center that I can never remember, but it has the word intellectual property in it somewhere. And every year in the spring, we like to hold a conference swirling around intellectual property issues. And it's no surprise that just about once a year we get to patents. And recently, just about once a year, we get to software patents. Another common theme for us is to touch on open source every couple of years. And so, you know, like two freight trains heading in opposite directions toward one another, we're colliding at this conference today, and we'll see if it's a real wreck with lots of high body count, or if instead we get lots of deep insights by continuing two conversations we've been having over the years. And so, thank you very much in advance for joining us. I also did want to send a few other thank yous. I find it's always best to do these at the beginning when we all have lots of energy, because these are really, really important. Most importantly, as always, I'd like to thank Anna Noskezi and Jamie Stewart for their wonderful administrative help getting this started for us today. So please join me in that applause. And with them at the front desk, Meg Ambrose has been pitching in, and great AV help, as always, from our IT department. I also did want to highlight the person who just spoke, Wendy Seltzer. It's really been wonderful having Wendy here for the year, and we have her for the rest of the summer, which is great. But you know, she isn't our typical fellow. She's really quite an established scholar in the field, and I think has spent a really fruitful year helping us at the center think about some issues that we hadn't given enough thought to in the past. And so it's with a lot of kind of regret that I have to see her leave in a few months. And one of the things we talked about early in the year was what to do with this conference. And really, the idea of patents and open source was very much her idea. She took the leadership in writing the write-up you see in your program, coming up with most of the invites that we have today. And so the last round of applause I'll ask you to join me in is a great debt to Wendy Seltzer for doing such a good job. This is largely a conference that swirls around the issue of innovation, and Wendy, among other things, has innovated the way that we do things here in our conference. And so the Twitter hashtag that we'll put up during the breaks, that'll be great. We're also going to start each panel with a 10-minute presentation. This is actually one of Brad Bernthal's innovations from his last conference, to help tee up issues in a more scholarly and substantive way. The key innovation, and for those of you who've been to Flatirons events in the past, you won't believe we're doing this. We're having breaks. And so between every panel today, Wendy has built in a 15-minute break with the idea that we'll have some excellent opportunity for networking and talking about what just happened rather than shushing everyone and telling people to get back to their seats. And so you have Wendy specifically to thank for that. I want to lay out some of the other ground rules for those of you who maybe haven't been to Silicon Flatirons before. We're largely a moderated discussion sort of conference series, so not a lot of set talks or PowerPoints for you today. We will have some, though, as I said. And although most of the questions will come through our three moderators, me, Wendy, and Professor Harry Serdin, we will love to leave time at the end, and we'll do our best to make sure we allocate a lot of time for your questions. There is a long-standing tradition at Silicon Flatiron started by Phil Weiser, which is a student must always ask the first question. And we're not afraid to call on students. And since it's final exams, there aren't many of you in the room, so you know who you are. So start thinking of those questions. And last and certainly not least, at the end of the day, we will go to the Betcher Hall right next door. Merchant and Gould is sponsoring the reception, and we'll have more opportunity to discuss what we've seen. And I'd like to specifically thank David St. John Larkin and Tim Skull for helping pay for the reception and pay for the alcohol that we'll have at the end of the day. So I lied earlier. Please join me in thanking Merchant and Gold for welcoming me. So this is my segue into the first panel. The three panels we have today talk about this collision, this freight train crash between patents and open source in three different ways, although I'm sure themes will overlap. The three themes, we'll talk about litigation and what this means in the typical patent lawsuit. We'll talk specifically in the last panel about patent standards and how that overlaps with patent law. But we're going to begin with the business model question. What does open source, which is supposed to be a model for innovation in software, and patent law, which is supposed to be a legal set of rules to get us at innovation, what do they say for the would-be startup entrepreneur? What do they say for the large established company, for the venture capitalist? And so we're going to have a discussion with four people who've really thought a lot about this, and I think it's wonderful that we can be joined. I'm not going to go through all the detailed biographies, but we're really, really happy to have Pam Samuelson from Berkeley's Law School and iSchool with us. Pam is there's no doubt, one of the nation's and world's leaders in intellectual property, and she's also been very integral in bringing Silicon Flatirons to where it is today. Pam is going to start us off with a presentation about some of the recent work they've been doing at Berkeley. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to talk today about the results of an empirical study that we did in 2008 of high technology entrepreneurs with a team of four people, my colleague Rob Merges and two fellows, Stu Graham and Ted Sickleman, both of whom are now full-time academics. While the I'm going to talk first about the sort of the survey altogether and kind of give you a little bit of a profile. I'm doing a follow-on paper to the main article, which is referenced here, which just looks at the software companies and all, although occasionally does some comparison with biotech, medical devices, and computer hardware, just because there are some ways in which software companies are significantly different in terms of their intellectual property strategy from those other companies. But let me just briefly tell you that we decided to do this study with funding from the Kauffman Foundation, which, as I'm sure you know, is interested in innovation and in entrepreneurship and innovation, And we wanted to find out, what do these high-tech companies think about patents and other forms of intellectual property? How does that motivate them or not? And then what might we learn that might be relevant for policymakers from this? So we mailed about 15,000 surveys to companies drawn from a couple of databases. Dun & Bradstreet is commonly used. Firms register, startup company register there in order to give themselves some visibility and credibility. And then Venture Expert is a database that has information about venture-backed firms. And so I noticed Dun & Bradstreet and Venture Expert here, because some of the slides later will show that even within the software industry, there are some differences between venture-backed firms in terms of their IP strategy and the Dun & Bradstreet firms, and so just highlight that. So we didn't get the kind of response rate that that empirical researchers like to get. We got 12% for the software companies and 24% for the biotech and medical devices companies. But we did have data about the non-respondents, and we sought some other data about the non-respondents, and we did a study and found no statistically significant differences between the non-respondents and the respondents in terms of company characteristics and in terms of patenting activity. And so while you can't be sure that this data that we have is reflective of what would be found if all of them had responded, nevertheless, we can speak with a little bit more confidence knowing that we did check to see. In fact, there was one statistically significant difference, which is more companies west of the Mississippi than east of the Mississippi responded to this to the survey, and we don't know whether that was a kind of California Berkeley bias or whether they're just nicer than the Easterners. So out of the 1,300 some responses that we got, 708 of the firms were software startups, and so that's actually more than half of the sample that we are our population. A quarter of those were venture expert, venture-backed firms, and three quarters were the Dun & Bradstreet firms. Overwhelmingly, we were successful in getting either the CEOs of the companies or the chief technology officers to fill out these surveys. So that was the kind of person that we were hoping to get rather than some R&D manager. A lot of the studies, a lot of the empirical studies that have been done have some are of big companies, and then they have some R&D manager person who might fill this out. So we think it's really nice to have some data from the company's leaders and founders. 85% of them were brand new startups. Most of the Dun & Bradstreet firms wanted to stay as private companies, and unsurprisingly, the venture expert firms mostly wanted to get acquired to go IPO. Here's some data about the average employees. And I think it's really interesting that half of the employees of these companies are engineers, so it's really a high-tech group. Now, the first interesting bit of data that we have is that the software companies are much less likely than the biotech medical devices companies to have or to be seeking patents. So about a third of the software firms overall had patents, but two-thirds of them didn't and weren't seeking them. Notice, though, that the venture expert firms were more likely, were essentially twice as likely, more than twice as likely as the Dun & Bradstreet firms to have sought or have patents. And there is some variation within sectors. So 90%, for example, of the venture-backed internet software companies had had or were seeking patents, while only 21% of the content companies were doing it. And again, in some ways, that's not terribly surprising, but still, it's useful data to have. Of the firms that have, that approximately a third of the firms in our sample that had patents, they had applied for about six patents each. The founder had, on average, brought in one patent, and then something under a patent each had been obtained by transfer once the company was founded. And you can see that the software companies are getting fewer patents by quite a lot than the biotech medical devices people are. When we asked why were they patenting, the first reason that was given was that they wanted to stop people from copying their technology, and that's a pretty, again, unsurprising, consistent with other empirical studies. But I think it's also really interesting that very close on was the idea of enhancing reputation, and then followed closely by efforts to secure investment and IPO chances. We think those are really important results that we were able to find. It's interesting that software firms were were much less likely than biotech firms to in-license patents. At some point, I'll be studying exactly why they were doing that. We have some data on that too, but I'm trying to give a 10-minute talk, so I can't get everything. But more than 60% of the respondents from the software companies actually thought that patents were important to VCs. So that's something which I think we'll talk about today. But even there was some importance to families and friends and commercial banks that were funding some of these startup companies. And in between, the angel investors, other companies that were investing in startups and other types of banks had kind of medium amount of interest in patents, where this is what the CEOs or CTOs were perceiving, right, about what was important. Of course, two-thirds of the companies weren't patenting, and so we asked also reasons why people were not patenting. The most common reason to say we weren't patenting was because of costs, and the costs are non-trivial. But interestingly, the next most significant perceived reason not to patent was because firms thought that the innovation that they could have patented wasn't patentable. And I'm not sure what to make of that exactly, but it is actually really interesting data. And here's a place where, as between the Dun & Bradstreet and the venture-backed firms, there was no statistically significant difference between sort of why they didn't patent or not. So that's, I thought, was somewhat interesting. Now, I think a question that's very relevant to all of us is, well, if you patent, then how important do you perceive patents to be for competitive advantage for the firm? And I think one of the things that's really interesting here is you can see patents rank dead last. Okay, out of 7 appropriability strategies, copyrights and trademarks are actually statistically significantly higher in valence than our patents. First mover and complementary assets were the first two importance. And contrast that with the biotech medical devices, where patents were the second most important appropriability strategy that the firms had. Here, again, there's a difference between the venture-backed firms and the general Dun & Bradstreet firms. Although the numbers are the same and the order is the same, you can see that the venture-backed firms have a slightly higher valence for patents and some of the other things. So they value first-mover advantage higher, too. So that's for what it's worth. We also asked a separate question about how much of an incentive were patents to invent new products, to engage in R&D for new products, and to undertake the risks of making new products. And they all came back and said, weak incentive. So I think that's interesting. And that's a stark contrast, again, with the biotech medical devices firms, for whom patents were moderately important for the same purposes. In terms of, again, another way of trying to ask that question, how important are patents? In our industry, getting patents makes it easier to enter an established market. they don't have any valence on that in particular. Easier for a first mover to stay ahead, slight valence. They're easier to make profits, not. And so the data really don't show that patents for the software companies are particularly important in these various ways. Now, one of the data points that I found extremely interesting, we asked two questions about open source. One is how much did the startup companies use open source, and more than 70% of the software firms that responded actually use open source software inside the shop, and notice that the venture-backed firms actually have a higher rate of use of that of open source than the Dun & Bradstreet firms. But both of them have much higher uses of that than the medical devices, biotech, and computer hardware. There's some variation also within subsectors, but the problem is there's small numbers here. Another thing that we think is really quite interesting is that more than a third of the software companies reporting having open source as part of their business model strategy. And so this was slightly higher among the Dun & Bradstreet firm than the venture expert firms, but nevertheless, a third of the companies did have open source as part of their business model strategy, and again, contrast that with the non-software firms where only 12% were using it. And in conclusion, sorry that's so fast, our data suggests that most software entrepreneurs do not own and are not seeking patents, although patenting is more likely when firms are venture-backed. The software firms do seek patents, they don't generally do so to attain competitive advantage, but to increase the likelihood of getting financing or to enhance reputation. Free and open source software is playing a more substantial role inside these companies and even in their business models than I think some people would have guessed. And Stu Graham and I are going to be doing a follow-on paper that does this deep dive into the data and tries to do correlations about kind of what can we learn here. So any questions that you have that you want us to try to answer, we're happy to do that. Thank you very much.
So I think that's a wonderful way to kick us off. I mean, there's so much in there to sink our teeth into. We probably could have taken each slide and just meditated on it for 10 minutes or so. I wanted to briefly introduce our other three panelists, but you'll have longer biographies that I commend to you because these are some impressive people. We have Jason Hazelmeyer, who's a partner at Home Roberts and Owen here in Boulder, and also the chair of the IP Advisory Board for Silicon Flatirons, a role that I'm very grateful he agreed to take this year. We have Jason Mendelson, partner and managing director of the Foundry Group, and guy we put on software patent panels to hear what he'll say, because it's always interesting, and Stormy Peters, executive director of the GNOME Foundation. And I think all three of these people do lots of things having to do with patents and software, but I find it interesting that we have someone who counsels clients about this, someone who funds new businesses, and someone who helps run one of these companies. Three very different perspectives. And before we cross and start talking more about open source, I wanted to start just with kind of software patents by themselves. And building on Pam's work, I'll ask this question first to Jason Hazelmeyer. Jason Schultz is here. We should have put him on the panel. We could have had three Jasons. Jason Hazelmeyer at the end, and we'll work our way down. But it's this continuing conversation we've had in Silicon Flatirons about whether venture capitalists, other investors, care at all about patent portfolios and patent strategies. And Pam has done us the favor of giving us numbers. In fact, how many times at our conferences have we said, oh, I'm sure there's some accurate number out there, but no one's measured it. We have numbers now. So, Jason Hazelmeyer, starting with you, how do you respond to that question, and in particular in light of maybe what we've learned from this latest research? Does this stuff matter at all? When it comes to startups, new companies, do they get software patents? Should they get software patents, et cetera?
I tend to look at it. It definitely matters. I think the statistics, while the numbers weren't necessarily high, did, if I'm characterizing the right, show a statistical significance in favor of venture-backed companies over the D&B companies in terms of considering them. And that fits with what we see out there with the venture-backed companies we work with and the once those companies are acquired, the larger companies that acquire them as well, which may tell part of the story. I tend to look at it, and I think tend to talk to clients about looking at it more as the what's the right tool for the right job. You know, you have a lot of segmentation within software. Certain of those segments, patents are far more prevalent than others, and the perception that you'd have patents or that you'd need patents to be a market player in one of those segments is different as well. And so I think going about it and looking at not only where you are as a software company, but then also really where your value is coming from as well. You know, there are plenty of companies out there these days that are neither software companies nor content companies, but some kind of hybrid between the two. And I think Web 2.0 and social media has kind of brought about a bit of a sea change in that, or a bit more prevalence there. You know, there it's really a matter of looking at where the value is and what's the best tool for protecting that value. I think. You know, the other side to look at this is how is it perceived? Venture-backed companies are looking at getting acquired, are looking at going public, because that still does happen these days. How do those who are the buyers in those situations, either the public or investment bankers or larger companies, look at those largely patent applications at the time of an acquisition? And I think that's what we see also driving a lot of the consideration by venture-backed companies, or a lot of the interest by venture-backed companies, is their potential investors, and I'll let the other Jason comment on that, him being in that chair, but also the acquirers. Just from my experience of having gone through a number of these deals, yeah, the IP and patents are typically scrutinized pretty closely, and I think that drives some of that maybe increased interest we've seen in the statistics.
So if we are a higher tech shop, here's where I would roll tape of Jason Mendelson from a past conference. So let me paraphrase saying, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. I hope I misrepresent you. It'll be more fun. I don't care if the companies I want to invest in have software patents. Now, let me amend that. It's a knock against them if they have software patents, perhaps because they're distracted and they should be doing better things with their time. I think you've said something like that from this podium in the past.
Yeah, you're slightly misrepresenting.
Oh, that's even better. So you know, give us the update, the one-year update, and is there anything in Pam's presentation that gives you pause or surprises you or confirms what you've always believed all along?
Well, I will tell you that I don't care about software patents. I think they shouldn't exist, so now you know my bias. I don't think it's necessarily a negative. I think the comment was based on when an entrepreneur comes to me and starts showing me their patent portfolio and I think it's going to impress me, and I want to fund them, that's a negative, because I realize they've got no touch with sense of reality. I think that Pam's presentation backs that up. It actually doesn't look like, from you know, the way I look at your data, is that the entrepreneurs don't care too much about it. There's a whole bunch of other things they care more. And if we're here to talk about innovation, and patents are about innovation, I think Pam's data says that it's failing. The current system is failing to provide an incentive to innovate in this country because of the patents. Now, we can say, but Jason, it looks like venture-backed companies have a higher percentage of desire for patents, and I believe somewhere in Pam's research there's a number that says 76% of venture capitalists think that patents are important. And I have one of two responses to that. Those are probably the dumb venture capitalists. Or, you know, we can dig into your sample size, but, you know, what's defined as a venture capitalist today is very interesting, because I see people all over the United States calling themselves venture capitalists, and they're not just Luke Wilson and the Wedding Crashers. But there's a lot of frauds out there. But let's leave that aside. From an innovative standpoint, I agree with, I'm not surprised. In fact, I'm comforted by her answers. From a venture standpoint, we have most of our companies have patents. Most of them have, as a defensive measure, this will tee up the next panel, most of them as a defensive measure for when somebody comes and tries to sue them. And they're not meant as a monopoly. They're never were an incentive. I know there's entrepreneurs out here who I've talked to, I won't call on you, John Bliss, who doesn't care, even though he's a former lawyer. This wasn't incentivized him. What incentivized me had this great idea and thought he could make a change and make a lot of money and change the world. And that's what entrepreneurs are incentivized, not by a patent scheme.
Great. And Stormy, and I know in the geek world, cred is all about pronunciation. It is GNOME, right?
It is.
Good. I'm glad I got that right. So maybe for the benefit of the audience, if you could spend a couple minutes just explaining GNOME and its role and your role in the organization. And then if you've thought at all about the use of software patents in your group or groups like yours, I'd love to hear those thoughts as well.
So GNOME is an open source software project. And if you've used Linux, how many people have used Linux? Right. It's the user interface. So you've used GNOME. You've seen the windows, the menus, some of the applications. That's GNOME. We have a couple thousand developers worldwide that work on it. About 40% of them are paid, and about 60% of them are volunteers. And we don't use patents. Pretty much our entire community is anti-patent. So if we were pro-patents and neutral patents, I would actually say that there's one negative about patents and startups is that if you're using open source software or open source software as part of your business strategy and you're hoping to engage that community out there, they don't like patents. They think they're evil, they think that they'll hurt them in the end, and they don't like them. So I think if you would look at all the open source software companies out there, very few of them advertise what software patents they have. Very few of them ever talk about what software patents they apply for, and I know some of them have patents. But that would be, it would be really hard for them to entice the community to work on software that they were then going to patent, or to support them in their efforts to produce proprietary software that had lots of patents in it. So I think it can actually be a negative to companies in that sense. I think patents have a place until we revamp the whole IP law system, you know, legal system. I think they have a place, but I think for open source software companies, it can hurt them, especially when it comes to recruiting developers.
And Pam, you know, if you want to respond to any of these, I'd love to hear if you have specific thoughts about what Jason Mendelsohn was saying about the venture capital response and the disconnect in his experience and the interviews that you guys had.
Well, the data that we have is from the CEOs and from the CTOs, and essentially what they said is they perceived that venture capitalists cared about patents. Wow. But we have more data than just this. We got them to check off that they had negotiated with venture capitalists, and then that they perceived. So we can do a little correlation to see not just that they perceived this, but had they actually done a negotiation, and it may be that, you know.
Can you explain what type of negotiation? I'm a little lost. Do you mean negotiation regarding the patents?
No. A negotiation for funding.
Okay, so they got a VC funding, and their perception was through this process that people like
yes,
them cared.
Yes, that's the data we have. So we don't actually have any data about how important the patents are to the venture capitalists. We have the CEO's reported perception in the context of a patent study, and I think, again, there may be a little bit of selection bias here, right? You're filling out something that's called the Berkeley Patent Survey, then you're more likely to sort of check the box that makes this seem important. But I think one of the things that we can say is that the perception that that patents were important didn't nevertheless, in some cases, lead to the companies getting patents, right? So that's a set of the correlations that I'm really interested in, is that we have, part of what I'm going to be playing with is that not everybody answered all the questions. We have, though, on this particular question, not just the people who have patents, but people who don't have patents answer that question too, although not the same number. So I think that we're going to find some interesting things that, notwithstanding a perception that the venture capitalists wanted patents, some of them don't get them anyway.
Said that, because the number that's getting thrown around, quoting some of your research, is that 76% of venture capitalists are for patents. That's what's getting...
Well, that's wrong.
I am so happy to hear you say that. So everybody go pass the word. Because, you know, when I look at your stats, you've had 88% of the software companies not respond. Then you got 12 that may have a bone to pick, as you point out, in selection bias. And then the bone...
Although I will tell you that we actually did check, again, the non-respondents and the respondents in terms of patents. And we did not find a statistically significant difference. We went in thinking, well, the people who are getting patents were more likely to fill out these surveys, but at least the effort that we made to do that correlation didn't result in our finding the kind of selection bias that we were concerned about. But again, it's hard to know.
Yeah. Was there a difference with the open source, the companies that said open source software is part of their business model?
That's one of the correlations I got to run over the summer. So I'm looking forward to doing this because I think that especially the correlations about what the open source strategy and patenting activity will yield some of the most interesting results.
We're going to wait till the end for questions, but I'll leave lots of time for this. So Stormy tees up the next part, which is really the point of the conference, is to bring these two worlds together, these two parallel schemes of providing innovation. And so I think I'll start with you, Stormy, and then I'll work down to Pam and then loop around to the Jasons. I am heartened that we haven't said the word Bilski yet. That's really surprising. We thought we might be the first academic conference in the country to discuss the new Bilski opinion, but the Supreme Court didn't comply with that. They never listened to me. So, Stormy, the question for you, and you've already talked about in the community the kind of hostility, I don't know if I can use that word, to software patents, but of course the community is also dishing up products that they hope get embraced, I think, by companies that aren't quite so hostile to software patents. And lots of business models are being built on it. And so the question I really want the panel to toss around here is this idea about the differences between patent as a business model and open source as a business model. Are there differences? Probably. Are they irreconcilable? Are there nice ways to marry the two and examples we can cite? So starting from your point of view, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this question.
Well, so there's definitely companies that have married the two. So like IBM definitely holds patents over things that are in open source, and they created a set of patents that they said they wouldn't enforce against the open source community, and that's being hotly debated right now, right? Because they did push one of their patents, and is it one of the ones they promised, and is the company, it's in the news.
This is the Turbo Hercules letter. Yes. No suit yet, as I understand.
No suit yet.
Okay.
I think the community's first reaction, even without knowing any of the details, shows how they feel about it. Without knowing any of the details, the news was all about how IBM broke their promise and IBM is suing open source software people. So that was their immediate reaction, because patents are evil and they'll be used against them someday. And that's kind of the mindset that they have. So I don't think that there's inherently anything that says you can't use patents in a business model and open source at the same time. But many of the people involved in open source really don't like patents. So I think there are people that work for companies that have patents, and I think the community is willing to work with companies that have patents. But I don't think, if there's ever a choice, the community is going to choose something that they think is anti-patent or patent-free.
And so, Pam, I regret that till now we've just used you as a database, and we've been asking you all about these numbers, and you can't let Pam Samuelson sit on a patent and panel and not ask her other questions. So I'd love to hear your take on this question about whether we're talking about two worlds that really have a lot of trouble fitting together when it comes to startup companies or established companies, or if examples like IBM, the Hercules thing notwithstanding, are a good example about how we can marry the two.
Well, I think there are three different approaches that I see. And I think the segmentation argument that was made a little bit earlier, there are certain segments where companies have patents, and they're not using patents as a part of their business strategy at all. Some places where they're doing proprietary stuff, they get patents and they're trying to use them in the kind of traditional way, and I think some of the kind of encryption software communities are places where patents have played a pretty significant role. I think there are open source where there's kind of active hostility to, and if you have some, you sort of say, oh, I'm only doing it for defensive purposes, and don't worry, I won't exercise them, and let's do a patent pool and the like. And actually, I think that's a pretty broad segment. I will tell you that I've done two other empirical studies of particular communities of software innovators. So I did a survey of the user interface design community about 10 or 12 years ago, and then I did another one of the computer graphics community, and in both of those, the hostility to patents was huge. So I think, especially among people who are actively innovating in these fields, that patents are really not viewed very positively. But I think there are other companies that basically have a mixed strategy. So here's the part of my thing that I'm willing to give away on an open source basis, but I may have a complementary software product that I would like you to buy, and I got a patent on something that's in that bin. And actually, to me, IBM is an example of that. Yeah, they dedicated some patents over here to protect the open source community, but a lot of the patents that they have are proprietary, are for the proprietary software that they have. And so I think that's a kind of mixed model. So I think there's no one. I think there's no one way of going about sort of having treating software and patents. I think that there are three different ways. But if you ask me the follow-up question, what would happen if, in the aftermath of Bilski, software patents just got thrown out? I don't think it would affect innovation in the software industry in a negative way. That's my humble opinion.
And so, because I'm not going to ask that follow-up question, I'd love another follow-up question, which is...
This is the easiest panel you've ever put me on.
Yeah, I think I'm going to begin to step out of my objective moderator's role and play some devil's advocate. No, but I do have a question, which is, this is this really intriguing thing you've set up here, Pam, which is crypto, UI, graphics, and how they have very, very different reactions. And I wonder if you've thought about or have theories on why the division. Is it... completely accident? Is it force of personality of the pioneers who started the field? So you have Richard Stallman and the GNU movement and the, you know, a certain set of philosophies. Or I think most intriguingly, could it be something inherent in the task they're trying to solve? Like crypto couldn't have got to where it was without patents, but it's less true for the others?
Boy, that's a great question, and I hope by the time I finish this project, I have at least tentative answers to it. I think some of it is historical accident and sort of who the leaders were. But I think one of the reasons why patents have been sort of a troubled area for 50 years. Okay, so I've written some. Historical pieces about this kind of software patents and why it's been troublesome. And this debate has been going on for 50 years. And so the fact that it's not resolved yet is, I think, fascinating. And we have at least another decade. So I think that's just a deeply interesting thing. But some part of it is that that we don't exactly know what to do with transforming data or presenting data. Somehow those kinds of innovations just don't have the feel of patentable innovations. And if you kind of go back to the Gottschalk versus Benson case, which was the first case that came before the U.S. Supreme Court that was a software-related patent claim, it was for transforming binary-coded decimals to pure binary form. And actually, IBM came in on an amicus brief arguing against the patentability of that innovation, saying that that was an algorithm that was a fundamental mathematical principle that shouldn't be patented. And so to the extent that we want to prevent patents from fundamental mathematical ideas, then that's going to not leave very much room, I think, for patents for at least some of the kinds of innovations that are important in the software world. So that's just a reaction.
So Jason Hazelmeyer, I'd love you to respond to any of these, but I think one thing we've been doing, because of the way I've been asking the questions, is this is very monolithic so far. It's IBM and it's GNOME and they all. Could you help us tease apart the different types of clients who walk into your office with software plays of any kind? And step us through the conversation when they say, look, I know something about patent law, but a lot of my programmers really like open source licensing. How do I do the cost-benefit analysis? And does it depend on the type of software play they are, in your mind?
So it's interesting. There's a quote that floats around in my head, and I've probably mentioned it far too many times in just those client meetings, but I was meeting with a pretty large company earlier this year, a company that has maybe an additional business model, which is, in addition to having some open source software that they're releasing, in addition to leveraging open source software in their software releases and in devices, they also have a very large patent portfolio that they license out in a standards-based industry. And we were sitting around a table, and someone made the comment saying, we fundamentally cannot develop software effectively these days without open source. And there was kind of that pregnant pause in the room, and someone else chimes in. In fact, if we figured out a way to do that, we'd patent it. And so it kind of, for this company, it fit perfectly because, there's kind of the Jekyll and Hyde within them of they can't live without open source and be commercially successful. And I think more and more, the statistic in the survey that said, 70-some% of the companies in one of the categories said they use open source. I thought, well, that means 30% are clueless because 100% do, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the way it is. You can't
avoid. Oh, you think the other 30% do, they just don't realize it. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely, I think they do. And because I think it's at the point, and it's long been at the point where the trouble to not do it so far outweighs, and be sure of it, so far outweighs the utility and the commercial reality of the situation.
Why would you pay for a web server, right?
Right, exactly. And it's going. I mean, it's getting higher and higher up the stack, right? There's more and more utility in open source. So at the same time, you have this, in the example of this company that where these quotes were thrown about, you also have a company that can't live without patents and is very much a software company. And this is one example. I'm sure there are others, companies that are represented in this room that would fall similarly into those categories. They're certainly not in some way in a situation where they can't coexist. In fact, I think more times than we know, they do coexist. You know, you certainly have the examples of situations where you have certain standards, for example, that are subject to patent, and someone goes in and says, well, we're going to build an open source implementation of that standard. Well, everybody can see that there could be problems there. But I think if you could actually have full transparency into the mapping of software patents and what they cover, I think there's plenty of open source that is legitimately covered. Good question as to why, with the commercial use of open source these days, why those patents aren't more widely asserted. Not just because of patent pledges like IBM and others have made, not just because of mutually assured destruction, because hey, you're not going to have two patent titans suing each other because they'll sue each other into the ground, but why is that the case? I don't necessarily have an answer for that, but it's interesting because I think there could be a lot more. I think when you look at this, of companies coming in and saying, gee, what should we do? More and more open source, not as a building block, but open source kind of in the category of as part of the business model, comes into play as a real point of discussion. Whereas 10 years ago, the thought of a software company walking into a lawyer's office and having a real discussion about giving some of their software away for free other than in a beta test kind of characterization or situation, I mean, that would have been about it. These days, it is a topic in just about every conversation I have with a fledgling software company, not as the only way, but is it another tool to pull off the shelf for the software company or software as a service company or software and content company or whatever it is, to be able to, I guess, better achieve their business plan. And I think that's the shift that I see with open source. As we become more comfortable with what open source is, and given it's fuzzy around the edges because, what truly is open source versus what isn't, you can get into a debate about that. But as there's more understanding of what it can do, what people can do with it, and how that translates into business value, you start to see it as another tool that companies are looking at. And I think that'll just grow. So it's not a matter of looking at the company as being an open source company or a proprietary company. I think we're long past that. I think it's more of a looking at, well, how are they using open source along with the other tools they have at their disposal to better achieve the business model, right? What's the most efficient way of running the business?
So, but then to follow up on that, going back to the original question, and that was very illuminating, but the other piece I want to get at is, so does it matter if they are doing software as a service, if they're sticking software in a sealed box that they're going to ship to their customers, if they're purely just going to use it internally to run their operations a little bit more leanly? Do you give them different pieces of advice about software patents and or open source based on which of those they're embracing?
Yeah, sure. The first, certainly. I mean, it's. I think it is very much contextual. And some of that's, could some of that context could very much change when the Bilski decision comes out in terms of what types of methods are patentable if they're software implemented. Certainly, from an open source standpoint, the just on a straight level of legal risk, the profile is different if you're a software as a service company or a cloud company versus shipping software on a device. In the case of if you had, for example, a license violation. And you kind of go on from there in terms of the differences. You know, I think, you know, Stormy may answer that question differently. I'd like to maybe hear Stormy's answer as well, in that, you know, there's different types of software available that is released under open source license that is better in different areas as well, or recognized as having more commercial potential at this point. So sometimes it's a matter of availability as well. Sometimes it's a legal issue, and there are probably other levels to analyze that as well.
I'll definitely come back to Jason Mendelson, but I'd love your Stormy's thoughts on that. I mean, I can't remember who said this, so I can just pretend it's mine. I read on the web someone saying that cloud computing may actually make the open source model a little less relevant, because all the user cares about is a working interface, and they don't really care what's running behind the scenes. I imagine you disagree with that, but I think it'd be interesting to hear in what way you disagree with that.
So it's actually my new campaign. Okay. So I have a keynote at OSCON, and I've been pushing for, I think, so the free software community pushed really hard to make sure we had free and open source software equivalents to all the proprietary software. And we have a desktop that's awesome, we have server software, we have an equivalent to all the proprietary software. And then free web services, as in free of cost, came along, and they forgot about it. It was free, and it was cool, and they used it, and they forgot that all those web services needed to have the same freedom as the software on their desktop and the software on their server. So I think the community has gotten a little lost, and there's quite a few people that are trying to push them into, we need to define what a truly free and open web service is and what that looks like. And it's not going to just be an open source software license that we have today. And even the Faro GPL license isn't sufficient to make your data free. So I don't think the patent issue changes it, but I do think that the open source software definition has not yet adapted to include web services in a way that's meaningful.
But that's really interesting. I mean, so is there a division then in the community? Are some people saying, you know, when we're talking about software that you buy and install and have in your hot hands, that's open source, but if all I'm buying is an interface, then I'm a little less concerned. I mean, I'm a privacy scholar, so I know there's lots of privacy issues lurking here, but is there a threat that half the community is going to split off and say, no, I don't care about the web services?
No, so I don't think it's that they don't care. It's just they think, well, you know, it doesn't matter that the Gmail's not open because I can download all my email from Gmail and make it easy to download my email. And so I can do that, and so I don't really need to worry about it. And then there's it's really convenient, and it's not very convenient to not use it. So Richard Stallman won't use any software as a service. He doesn't use Gmail, he doesn't use Flickr, he doesn't use any of them. And try to tell your average software developer, that they can't use any web service, and they're going to laugh at you. So I think it would be very inconvenient for most people in that world to suddenly decide that web services aren't open enough. So I think they're in denial. I think it'll eventually be fixed, just like software was, but it's going to software on the desktop, but it's going to take a while.
So Jason Mendelson, I love your responses to any of this. The one thing I want to add is, we keep using IBM as this model, you know, thousands and thousands of patents, and also a business model that, at least on paper, embraces open source. So the question is are they relevant at all to the way you think about the companies you're funding, or are they just a bad model because they're huge and they've got different types of abilities and concerns?
I don't know. I don't think about IBM much.
Okay.
I guess the way I'd phrase it is we're sitting around having a discussion about when you use patents, when you use open source, are there business models? And I think you can look at this pretty easily on an XY axis. So the X axis is what the perceived security risk or tolerance of the code. And that can be, you know, on one end of the spectrum, you have an internet content company that people are posting videos of their dogs and cats doing things, which is no security. On the other end, you've got maybe some proprietary web security algorithm that's really important. And while patent has certain disclosures, people aren't able to kick the tires like they are in open source. And if you're trying to keep your code more secure, you tend to work in a more patent world than an open source. On the y-axis, though, you need to figure out what type of innovation model you are. The collaboration innovation model, which I would argue is probably the most vibrant today, is very attuned to open source and multiple people working on it. Whereas vacuum innovation, where in that vacuum could be one person in their basement or a company that keeps everything nice and tight, that's a different type of innovation. And when you're looking as a venture capitalist or an entrepreneur, you're looking at a business model and you're trying to balance these things, I always look at the XY axis and kind of find out what quadrant I'm in to figure out what might be that business model. And it doesn't have to be a business model for the whole business. You can have a business that's got a very locked down core and open source the periphery so people are innovating on the applications and whatnot. I mean, this isn't anything to do with patent, but the perfect example we have right now is Apple. They have this App Store, iPod, iPad, iPhone architecture, which is massively closed. There's nothing more closed. I mean, Adobe can't even get on it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have this complete collaborative innovation happening on the actual applications running on this closed platform, which is massively innovative, it's in a big environment. And I think that business, you know, that's the perfect hybrid business model. You can apply that to IBM, which they're trying to do. I would probably agree with Stormy's earlier comments that people might think IBM's evil just because they're big bad blue and they've got all these patents. But even startups can act like that, where they can still lock down something that they're just terrified of, or they don't want people to innovate on it because they want to control that user experience, but still leave a core that's open and innovative upon in an open manner.
One reason I liked having Wendy around all year is we've been debating the iPad and the iPhone all year long. I mean, I want to understand just that last argument.
You mean this thing?
Yeah, exactly. The thing I was noticing before the panel. And that we're a little far afield of the panel topic right now, but I just love to take. So you're embracing what Apple's doing, basically. I mean, you call it this hybrid strategy. I wasn't sure in the way you were framing it.
I respect Apple's strategy.
Okay.
I mean, as a guy who's maniacally focused on the user experience and the product,
yeah.
I'll tell you, they've got that figured out, right? Nobody's going to deny. I mean, they've got the sexiest, best stuff. On the other hand, they're totally closed, and they piss a lot of people off, whereas Windows is a total whore, and the thing crashes all the time. So, you know, pick your poison. But, you know, I respect what they do.
Huh? Linux.
Linux, yeah.
Isn't Apple
based on PSD? Yes, I can't wait for the support call from my dad on Linux. That'll be the day that I buy my first gun.
My dad moved and I haven't gotten a call yet.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I did have a specific follow-up question, but
Pam... But the iPad's cool.
No, it is cool. But Pam, I'd love to hear your take on the two themes that have been swirling around in the last couple of... responses, and they kind of come together at some point, which is the kind of what Mendelsohn calls the Apple hybrid model of lots and lots of maniacal control. I like that phrase in the core. And then something that seems open on the periphery. And then the second one was the software as a service question, the cloud, and what that is doing for our old debates about freedom and openness. And I think where they come together for me is, right, so I hacked this Windows phone last night, and now it's a Google Android phone. And the first time hypothetically, and the first time I ran it.
So did you just make an infringing device?
No, I would never do that. And I would never cop to that either.
But
the first time I hypothetically did it, it crashed like for an hour, and then I had to start over and figure out what was wrong. So to me, this is kind of combining the two, right? I've got this cloud-based device now, and one that's really open, much more than the Apple model. But I've also wasted 4 hours of my life trying to get it up and running. So, I mean, any of these you want to take a swing at, Pam? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I think the Apple hybrid model. I think Google also has gotten more credit for openness than it deserves, because it's very closed about a whole bunch of things. And I think that's been true of IBM. And some of the big players have been very good at sort of figuring out a good strategy for what the thing is going to be that's totally closed, that's proprietary, and that I'm patenting like crazy, and what kinds of things that I'm going to be open and encourage innovation kind of on the edges and drive interest in my platform. And so that seems to me to be a business strategy, and as long as we're in a competitive environment, that doesn't seem troubling to me. I'm actually more troubled by the software as service cloud model, at least in terms of sort of moving forward, to the extent that to me, actually, there's no need to get a patent or a copyright or any other formal intellectual property protection if you're talking about software as a service, because it's all in the cloud, it's all behind the wall, and trade secrecy and technological protections turn out to be, to me, the things that are important. But that means that some of the reverse engineering that we used to be able to do in order to be able to get access to information and then innovate on top is not going to be as available. And so to the extent that, you know, part of what years ago my colleague Jerry Reichman talked about was how one of the reasons why software was particularly troubling for, you know, for the world of intellectual property was because there was, in the kind of old manufacturing era, you could keep a lot of the sort of really important sweet sauce inside the factory and hold it as trade secrets, and you didn't really need patents for a lot of that stuff because you didn't want to disclose the stuff. So essentially, and then if you introduced a product into the market and it wasn't easily reverse engineered, then you'd have this long-term competitive advantage. With software and with some other kinds of information technology products, all of a sudden the know-how required to make an equivalent product was either on the face of the product or easily reverse engineerable, and in which case then patents seemed more important and license restrictions on reverse engineering were proliferating. And now what we have, I think, with software as a service kind of inside the cloud is that essentially the secrets migrate back inside the factory walls, so to speak, and so trade secrecy becomes more important. But then, you know, that's good for the companies, but in terms of sort of the kind of ongoing innovation that we might have otherwise seen where you're kind of in this more hybrid model may not happen. So that's just kind of my thoughts about the cloud.
So, Pam, is that does that make Google the new Microsoft and Apple?
Of
and
course.
Does that make the GPL the new BSD MIT?
Well, I'm not going to go that. I think that we're going to see some very interesting public policy issues arising.
And I'm not even going into Paul's, you know, line of work or main line of privacy. I mean, I agree. Just on a from an open source standpoint, I mean, it's always kind of funny the free pass that Google seems to get, or that other fill in the blank large cloud providers. I suppose Amazon could fall in this category too, that are so clearly leveraging open source, but yet legally have no obligation, are essentially skirting the obligation, or have no obligation to contribute back. So they're not really. They're community participants only voluntarily, right, or only when they choose to be, and can highlight that, but not, you know, but don't have to play by the same rules that everybody else who's not there is doing, even with the Affero GPL. I mean, because it's just not as prolific as, or it hasn't proliferated as much as you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I said earlier I played devil's advocate, but I think I might actually believe this one, which is, I mean, I think the response is well, maybe I don't believe this, but let me say it anyway. The difference is open source, right? The definition, the notion of freedom has always been the people who make it and the people who use it. And I think the complaint now is you're using it in ways that blur the line of creation and just use. But I think if... What's that?
An ownership.
But I think if Google were here, they'd say, I don't know what you're talking about. We are very active users, and they probably do contribute something back to the code base.
In fairness,
what's
they
that?
Do. Right?
A lot of money.
And money as well. I mean, I think they would say, you know, so as users of open source, under the old definition of freedom and not freedom, where we adhere to everything the community says, the problem is the goalposts of freedom seem to be moving a little bit. And we're being faulted for having something that wasn't part of the original conversation now closed.
You can probably shoot holes in this on some level, but it's not unlike a company that holds patents but has no operations, right? They kind of are unassailable on a large level because they have no operations themselves. A company that uses open source but distributes no software but still does business with it, there is unassailable on an entire legal level as well.
Does anyone else want to respond to this?
There is a group of the open source software community that does think that web services, the way they're built now, are wrong. Richard Stallman's firmly in this camp, but there's quite a few others, and they're working on distributed type, they don't call them web services, but distributed apps. So instead of putting your photos on Flickr, you put your photos kind of in this cloud that's built up of all your friends' machines, and you can decide whether your photos live on your machine or their machines or there's copies. So they think that the centrally hosted web services are evil, and that we should make more of a distributed model where the people still own and control the data as opposed to a company somewhere.
I think we're just redefining evil a little bit. Yeah. I think we are, but I think that's great. I mean, I think that might be valid, but we're pointing to a different aspect of what they're doing as evil than perhaps we were when it was just the software that we were shipping on CDs.
It has to change. The world has changed, and the definitions have changed. So,
I want to open up to the audience in 1 second, but I want to take a quick shift and get from these lofty philosophical heights to something a little bit more mundane, but I think important, which is, and anyone can pick this up, maybe Jason Hazelmeyer, I have a feeling you'll have something to say. What about the Front Range and the way the startup community and culture works out here might render different answers to anything we've been talking about than, for example, Silicon Valley? I mean, Brad's last conference has me thinking a lot about place. And then Jason Mendelson, I'd love to hear your response. And Stormy and Pam, if you can compare it to other places around the country. I mean, is there? And then Jason Hazelmeyer, one more for our students in the audience. Is there a law firm practice around this, or is it you and a few other people? I mean, can they go into the open source advising world once they graduate here?
So I that's an easy answer. Yes. Okay. I mean, I think maybe second only to privacy. Right. Over the next
that's our 5 to 10 years,
you know, it kind of becomes I think it becomes more and more of just a. It can be a separately defined practice, but it just becomes something, a skill set you have to have as a lawyer to be able to work in software-related technologies, not just on the patent side of the world, because you certainly have those issues, and I think the litigation panel can dig into some of that a little bit, but you have the you certainly have the software licensing issues. But one of the things that I always look at as the Front Range having, that other places have, but we certainly if you could graph it, we have a high percentage of it, is kind of this collaborative community. You know, a Techstars is an example of that. It survives because, or it flourishes the way it does because of the efforts of David Cohn, of Brad Feld, of David Brown, of Jared Polis, of the others who are the central founders behind it. It certainly benefits because of the great talent of the Techstars founders that come through each summer. But it is really the community that's built up around that, largely for no direct economic benefit, but for the participation and for the collaboration, I think for the energy that kind of is built around something like that, or that is generated around something like that, that is the mark of success of Techstars, or one of the secret sauce of Techstars, right, is the community. There are other examples. I don't say Techstars has cornered the market on that. And other examples, even in the Front Range, that's a recent one that I think has tapped into that, somewhat knowingly, somewhat unknowingly. You know, when it comes to from the standpoint of collaborative development of software, which is the hallmark of open source, good question. I don't have any ability to say that there's a high percentage of open source developers or contributors here per capita or not. You know, I think, though, that unscientifically, the companies that I talk to here, and these are larger companies, ones that are public or larger private companies, as well as the angel and venture-funded startups, there is a high level of I think, comfort with open source as an option. Not of, again, jumping in with both feet and becoming an open source project, but of, again, using open source as one of the tools that you'd use along with the other legal tools or business tools you'd use to accomplish your business model. And so I can't help but thinking that the two of those run together because they both seem to be prevalent here.
So Jason is one who funds companies in both places. I mean, is there a difference with these particular issues?
Yeah, there is. So I've lived in Silicon Valley for 10 years before I've been 4 years ago I moved here. I think I agree with what Jason says about the collaborative nature of Boulder, which is very special, and if you ever forget it, go live in Silicon Valley and figure it out. But more importantly, there's less capital here, and so people who form companies by definition need to use open source, by definition need to be more collaborative, by definition need to be contributing back more to those systems and making connections and friends with people throughout the country so that the system itself works. They can't automatically walk down Sand Hill Road, get a $10 million check, do a closed system and build everything from scratch. And there's a very, very big difference. Even the companies I see in the Silicon Valley that are active in the open source community are more of the Google model, the users, than the givers. I've been incredibly impressed with this community over the past 4 years, what they've given back to the open source initiatives that I've paid attention to.
Stormy?
Yeah, so something Jason Hazelmeyer said made me think of this. He talked about all these people that are working in Techstars, not for economic gain, for some other reason, and I'm reading a book called Drive by Dan Pink, and he said our definition of economics has to change. First people did things for survival, and then people did things for economic gain to make money. And we still in this world assume that most people are doing what they're doing to make money, but there's a huge set of people that do things to innovate or to have fun or to solve puzzles, and we aren't yet taking those into account when we think about the Boulder community, the open source software community. There's another factor driving a lot of that stuff besides just money.
And Pam, I'm happy we've got you out here enough that you're now an honorary citizen of Boulder. So, but as one from the Bay Area, I mean, do you see differences from when you visit here and learn about what's going on?
Well, I think that the sort of the characterization of the Bay Area as less collaborative and less kind of open to open may be a bit overstated. I think that partly because, you know, there isn't really one software industry. There are lots of communities that exist where some parts of what we call largely the software industry is more collaborative and less, you know. So I think it's a more mixed bag, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was more a higher concentration of collaboration in this community. And you know, I think at the time that Silicon Valley kind of really took off, it was at a time when there was a lot more open collaboration in some sense than there is today. It's a good idea to go back and reread Anna-Lee Saxenian's book Regional Advantage, because part of what this I take the lesson of that book to be was if you looked at Boston and the Route 128 area and you looked at Silicon Valley, kind of there was a time when it looked to most people like Route 128 was going to be the big innovation engine, and partly it didn't end up that way, at least in the software area, because they were so much more close. They were more proprietary. The trade secret rules were stronger, the sort of covenants not to compete were enforceable, and there was a lot less of the kind of social networking in a kind of, you know, way that allowed information of all kinds to pass around. So I think in some sense, you know, the culture has changed since those early days, but the innovation that grew out of that kind of more, you know, loose social networks, lots of information flow, people working at this company for a while, then moving to the other company, and they took some things that people in Boston might have said, oh, that's a stealing of trade secrets, and we just sort of allowed that information to flow around a little bit more. So I think that there's innovation and collaboration isn't just a new phenomenon.
Okay, so once invoking the Weiser rule, is there a student in the room? So I think it can't go without noting that this is Blake Reed's probably 10th time asking the first question at a conference, and in 1 week will no longer be a student and cannot save the rest of you. And Blake has asked some great questions over the years. So Blake, why don't you go ahead and ask your last first question?
All right. Blake, hope it lives up to the billing. So we've been talking about open source sort of as a monolith, but obviously it's a lot more granular than that. There's a huge proliferation of licenses out there, and at least historically, kind of from a legal perspective, they're agnostic about software patents and using them. So it sounds like entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, folks developing software are willing to engage software patent or are in developing with open source because they can kind of hedge their bets and maybe use software patents later down the line when they get bigger, that sort of thing. But we've seen the proliferation of licenses recently, like GPL v3, that really draw a line in the sand on software patents, and you kind of make a big commitment to never using them if you go down that road. So I'm just wondering if in the last couple of years that's increased any kind of tensions between venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, software developers, and the open source community, or if it's posed any kind of challenges for people wanting to engage on that front.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, and if anyone has a specific example of a company that you think may have gone GPL, but the patent provisions of V3 have been a problem, I'd love to hear about it. So anyone, this is a jump ball, anyone who wants to take that question. Or just about the licenses, the differences between the licenses a little bit more broadly.
I'll jump in two points. One is I was involved on behalf of a couple clients in the drafting of GPL V3, and the provision you cite was a very controversial provision and went through as was made public.
And some of the audience may not know. Can you give the
GPL version at a high level? GPL version 2 has what we refer to as an implied patent license clause that doesn't come out and expressly grant a patent license, but does it in an implied way, and because it's implied, the extent to which it's implied is subject to some ambiguity. The decision was made in drafting GPL version 3 to, among other areas, come out and have express clauses around, let's say, the rights to the patents that a GPL licensor may hold in the software in the software license under GPL version 3 that they would distribute. And the clauses are far more express and create some big implications to the point where two points. One is there is a big difference, I think, in companies that are comfortable with GPL version 2 versus GPL version 3 just on a policy basis. Again, unscientifically, in the open source policies, open source use policies that companies have, there's a huge gap there to the point where GPL version 3 is more taboo. Not just for that reason, but certainly that being one of the reasons. GPL version 2, maybe as a result of the foil of GPL version 3, has become more benign seeming, I guess, you know, to a lot of companies. Oh, GPL version 2, sure, we can use that. Whereas 5 years ago, my gosh, that was the big evil, right? And so that's an interesting dynamic. The other dynamic that I see a lot more on the legal side, and I'm hoping that the other couple of panels will tap into this as well, is it used to be that when my phone would ring and I'd get a call about an open source issue, it would be license compliance. And that still happens quite a bit around, we're distributing open source software, maybe we're modifying it, do we have to distribute the modifications under the GPL or don't we? Or we're linking to open source software that's licensed under the GPL, are we linking in such a way that creates a work based on the program, a derivative work such that it becomes part of the GPL software? Those questions are still out there. What's out there now as more of a prevalent issue is, my gosh, we hold patents. We know it relates to some of our software. We've used open source to implement some of that, or to essentially in our software stack, some of the technology that's covered by those patents. Some of that open source software is covered by GPL version 2, or maybe GPL version 3, or maybe another license with another type of more express patent license. My God, what are we doing to our patent portfolio? And take that a step further, we're in open litigation over some of those patents. Is our distribution of open source software inherently giving those who we're in litigation with defenses against us because we've inherently granted them patent licenses over some areas that relate to that open source software? I mean, these are the questions that are coming up now around open source and patent litigation that I think you had out there, but on a far smaller scale 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 7 years ago. Now, given the GPL V3 has only been around for 2 or 3 years at this point, so some of that has just come to head there, but I think that's where there's a new tension going on.
Any other thoughts on V3 or the different licenses? And our next panel, of course, is going to pick up on a lot of this when we talk about patent litigation and open source. Okay, questions from anyone else in the audience? Yeah.
Quick for Pam Graves, lines available in our open source.
I haven't decided yet.
the paper's available.
The Berkeley Patent Survey generally, that report is available on SSRN, and if you do a query on the 2008 Berkeley Patent Survey, you can quickly find the article by Graham Merges, Samuelson, and Sickleman. And that has most of the data in it, including some of the data about the software companies. But I'm still working through kind of the software-specific study yet, and so I'm expecting that I'll have a version of the paper available in the next 6 months, but I don't feel comfortable right now.
Yeah.
Pam, this is for you as well. Are there any collateral studies that you're aware of that address the financial impact of the patents that have been granted or not been granted and correlated to the kinds of perceptions that you have studied?
Right? Well, again, I think the first place to look is the is the report of the 2008 Berkeley Patents Survey, which is available on SSRN. It has a whole section about this. There also are a couple of follow-on papers that Ted Sickleman and Stu Graham have written about why do startups patent, and one of them was written before we did this study, and one of them was written after. And so, because financing is one of the concerns, those papers take a look at that. I'll tell you that I like my co-authors a lot, but I have a somewhat different take on some of these subjects than they do, particularly on the financing issue. Ronald Mann has also done a qualitative study about the impact of patents on financing. This is more, he did a set of interviews and he reports on it. I once gave a copy of that article to Mitch Kapor, who's an old friend of mine, and we were teaching a class on open source together, and I asked him to read it, because it said some things about open source, and I said, well, what do you think about this? He said, it's not even wrong.
So financing was not...
Which I took to be a very big insult.
Financing was not exactly the question I meant.
I'm sorry.
It's really financial impact. That is to say, if you look from, you know, from start to finish,
yeah. Okay.
Of the financial impact of what the companies that did pursue versus yeah. those that didn't pursue,
what those
outcomes were, because the perceptions are interesting,
yeah.
And beside those perceptions, would be really interesting to see whether there's any data that backs the perceptions.
Right? Well, I mean, part of the problem for our particular study. Is that most of the companies are 10 years old or younger. And so so we do have, there's a non-trivial, I'm just off the top of my head, I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact data, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 10% of the companies had either been acquired or gone IPO. So we do actually have some, and we have data about what their annual revenues are. And so we are going to be doing some stuff. Also, because we're going to keep the data set and grow it over time, we're going to be able to see how these companies evolve over time in terms of the financial impact of things. But one thing that I can say is that the reports of the companies is that getting software patents is really expensive. The average price that they were quoting was $40,000. And for a startup company, $40,000 is like the difference between an engineer for a half a year and not. And part of the reason I have some interest in this is my husband started three companies. The last one was quite successful. And so I lived across the table for many years with somebody who started a company. And, you know, if the question was, are we going to spend money on patents or are we going to hire a new engineer? Hiring a new engineer was always the most important priority.
We'll provide a link to Pam's paper on our website for this conference. So you'll find it there. Maybe time for one more question. Go ahead. Right here.
My question is working back is whether the concept of privacy or an analogous idea ultimately is a trump card against these other concepts that, you know, if you some of these things around open source development, trade secrets that are implicit in iPad-type app store applications, are these things, the difficulties with patents and open source software, does it become ultimately trumped by something like a privacy concern as we move forward? I mean, it sounds like, you know, like with Pam's studies are sort of documenting in some ways that some of these concerns are fading already as they end up behind a wall of SaaS applications or an app store or practically the necessity for when you're practicing law that some of your clients for which you've been advising your clients is around GPL licenses and things like that. So does the answer become this ends up behind a wall and it's a privacy concern?
So let me rephrase that, because I've been thinking about this. I've written a book review with James Grimmelman of J. Jonathan Zittrain's book. And the one thing we say is, you know, too often the conversation is innovation, 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 and there are all these other values lined up. And a lot of this has been inherent, I think, in a lot of Stormy's comments using words like evil and freedom. So the question is, I mean, do we make a mistake at a conference like this to only talk about innovation? And then I guess to bring in the question even more, do lots of other things seem to trump innovation? And should they trump more often than they do in our policy debates? So anyone want to try and take that? I mean, whatever value you want to embrace, freedom from dictatorship, free speech, free press, privacy.
I think that actually, to me, the sort of really interesting thing is sort of how dynamic things are. That, you know, that I think you were saying, you know, 10 years ago, the idea that someone would come into your office and talk about giving any part of their software away for free was a heresy. It was inconceivable that that would happen, and yet now it's really a very common phenomenon. But I think the cloud computing area is definitely one where the nature of the policy problem changes dramatically, and where really you're talking about lots of other concerns. So I would say, you know, I couldn't go through this and not mention Google Books at all. So Google Book Search is obviously one of the great applications in the cloud that will be out there. And the privacy issues, I think, are among the most important and salient, and I think dwarfs the intellectual property issues, even though, obviously, if the case settles, the intellectual property issues will have taken care of themselves. But the privacy issues, I think, can trump other things in terms of the policies that are at stake.
Yeah, I think we've put in some values over others without even realizing it. So we've put innovation, making money, easy to use, above things like freedom and privacy. So we all use the web services because they're very easy to use and they make our life easier. We give up some of our privacy and some of our freedom in order to do that. You don't just see it in software. I mean, you see it across the board. I mean, my kid has to be in a car seat till he's six. Anyone who knows me knows that drives me nuts. We put safety over freedom of choice. So I think we should look at our values every once in a while. And are we taking easy to use over freedom or privacy? Are we taking money over freedom or privacy?
Anyone else? I think where I'd end on this particular question is if any of you have the notion that academic writing can be boring, I want to disabuse you of it by having you read the New York Times editorial written by Larry Page, or was it Sergey, by one of the Google founders. And then right when you're done with that, read Pam's response in the Huffington Post, which is the closest thing to an academic smackdown you'll ever see about Google Books. It's a really, really interesting contrast in studies. Thank Wendy Seltzer again for giving us a break. We've never had one of these after one panel at Silicon Flatirons. But before you take this break, please join me in thanking the panelists.
That was fun. I like these.